Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a fictional look at what the Colorado River's future could look like.
And celebrating the indigenous history of Route 66 on its centennial.
But first, Arizona voters approved adding constitutional protections for abortion rights in 2024. But that hasn't stopped state lawmakers from taking up the issue in various forms since that time. And this week, they'll be debating and voting on a handful of issues related to abortion. One bill would make it a Class 2 felony for someone to give a pregnant woman an abortion-inducing medication without her knowledge or consent. Another would allow a court to order child support retroactively to the date of a positive pregnancy test. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol. Howie, good morning.
Good morning.
So, as I mentioned, a number of sort of abortion-adjacent related bills. I'm wondering, though, how you've looked at all of these. Like, is there a theme or any sort of common threads between all of these?
Well, as you point out, voters approved Prop 139 in 2024 by like a 3-2 margin, and it placed in the Arizona Constitution a fundamental right for a woman to terminate a pregnancy prior to fetal viability, which is from 22 to 24 weeks. Lawmakers have kind of tried to nibble around the edges of that to see, well, what can we do? And when I say lawmakers, I'm talking about those who oppose abortion. Now, some of these are dealing with the question of who is a human being. And that's really the common thread that you're finding in there. For example, if in fact you go ahead and make the murder of an unborn child felony murder, the same as if you were murdering a quote-unquote live person, you have created a personhood status for that fetus, at least in terms of that statute. I think a lot of the fears of people is that once you start doing that, you give the fetus other forms of status. You have another support, one that you mentioned about the child support, retroactive date of a positive pregnancy. Here too, this language defining quote-unquote preborn person as a human offspring from conception to birth. Then there are things that are designed apparently to deter people from getting an abortion. It would require the State Board of Education to come up with a mandatory program where students would go ahead and would have to go ahead and say, here's what you need to learn about abortion. Here's what you need to learn about the various stages of a human development. When did they develop a spinal cord? When did they develop arms and legs, presumably with pictures? Now, is that anti-abortion? You know, on one hand, it's just simply biology. On the other hand, I think the foes say what you're trying to do is tell them this is a human being and therefore you should not be able to abort it.
Well, Howie, I wonder if that sort of fetal personhood argument is one that might, assuming that any number of these bills get to Governor Katie Hobbs, that might bring out her veto pen.
Oh, I think the veto stamp is poised and ready. I mean, you know, she has got her ratio this year. Actually, she's vetoed more bills this year than she signed. But she's also made it clear that one of her touchstones, while she's willing to negotiate on things like the budget, like the spending, is to protect what she believes are individual rights and protect what's in Prop 139. She made a very public display of signing Prop 139's petition to get it on the ballot. And anything that she sees that will get between a woman and her doctor or a woman and her family is totally unacceptable to her.
Sure. Howie, let me ask you about another bill that's going to come up for debate in the Senate later today. And this has to do with cities and collecting sort of wayward shopping carts from like grocery stores and places like that.
Well, this is an interesting one because we've all seen as we've wandered around neighborhoods, just shopping carts have been abandoned somewhere. They're also being used to a certain extent by homeless people. And cities are saying, you're creating litter out here. Now, from the perspective of the grocery stores, they're saying, wait, we are the victims here. We let customers use shopping carts. We've tried to put in things so the wheels lock up, you know, when you cross a certain point, but we can't do everything. And so why should we be penalized? That's what Phoenix is doing with their ordinance. They're saying, if in fact we find your shopping carts out there and you don't have a program to try to retrieve them yourselves, we will charge you a fee every time we have to get it returned to you. Again, the businesses are saying, wait, you know, we're the victims. It was stolen from us. Is it so different if, as opposed to anything else that is stolen by people? Now, the argument of lawmakers is these are specifically what they call mobile devices. And because they're mobile and because of the fact that they can be stolen so easily and can be abandoned so easily, and there is a history of banning them, that we should force grocery stores to do more. You get into some interesting issues there between the rights of cities to protect their neighborhoods and the rights of businesses who say, you know, we shouldn't have to pay because somebody else steals our grocery carts and leaves it over on the corner of Mill and you know, University in Tempe.
Well, and so the bill up for debate would basically tell cities you can no longer charge those fees, right? So in theory, if a city has to go out collecting shopping carts, they cannot charge Safeway, Fry's, Trader Joe's, whomever for the practice of bringing those cart of collecting them and bringing them back.
Yeah, and that's what HB 2460 would do. It'd be a preemption, and as you know, lawmakers love to preempt what cities do. Cities say we're in the best position to protect our neighborhoods, and it comes down again to, do we allow the state to say, no, you shouldn't be able to do this, but then you leave the cities with the problem, and they say, we can't afford to go out and have a guy with a pickup truck go out and pick up things and return them to their rightful owners.
Yeah, interesting.
Is that the job of the city? You know, it depends on who you talk to.
I guess that'll be part of the debate later today. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Busy week again at the state capitol coming up. Howie, thanks as always.
Have a great day.
Late last month, a California jury found Meta and YouTube harmed a young girl who used the platforms with addictive design features. It's being called a landmark case and likened to social media's big tobacco moment, referencing the case that found cigarette companies created an addictive product that harmed people who used it. But our next guest this morning says how we regulate social media for kids doesn't end with finding who's at fault. Brad Snyder is an author and researcher who studies kids for governments and companies like Warner Brothers Discovery, Cartoon Network, and Nickelodeon. He's also the host of the podcast Talking About Kids. I spoke with him more about this case and asked if he thinks this trial marks a turning point for kids in social media.
I guess so. I mean, well, first of all, I think that these companies were engaged in practices that they knew were against the law and were potentially harmful to kids. And so for that, I'm glad that they're being held accountable. But in the larger way, I feel like what we've done is akin to suing an automobile manufacturer to make their cars safer. But we've done nothing to help drivers drive better.
Because the argument here, right, is that they're making a product that is as addictive as cigarettes or casinos, that kind of thing. But you're saying it's not necessarily about the product, it's about how people use it.
Well, and again, we're looking at examples of two in particular social media sites, if you consider YouTube to be a social media site, which, by the way, in Australia's ban of social media, that doesn't include YouTube.
Right.
But I would say that this lawsuit is against two particular apps, and our kids are on screens wherever they go, and they are being interacted with not just through Instagram, but through, you know, myriad of platforms and through video games and even through their TVs.
So this is the first time a social media company, though, has been found at fault in a case like this in
right.
this kind of personal way. There's a legal precedent here as well. It validates this legal theory that social media sites, apps can cause personal harm or injury.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned, in Australia, we're seeing, you know, nationwide bans on youth on social media or some social media. We're seeing lots of states enact laws. It feels like there is momentum to try to stop young people in general from being able to use these things because of the harms they bring. Do you think that that's the answer?
Well, I've been watching Australia, and again, it's a little too soon because the ban really went into effect at the end of 2025. Anecdotally, though, there's been plenty of interviews of young people in Australia saying things like, well, these social media sites that were banned, we're not using them anyway, or we've moved to these other sites. And again, what that says to me is that, you know, mechanizing supervision and care of young people just doesn't work. And it really never has. And what I mean by that is anytime we think that the answer is to take a TV away or to forbid this program or forbid this app, we've done nothing to actually give youth the skills they need to make better decisions and to be healthier regardless of the app, regardless of the platform, regardless of the screen.
So let's talk about what that would look like and what research shows here. I mean, it's been described in some research as like a double-edged sword. We shouldn't think about it as like more use equals more harm. It's more how teens use it. Doom scrolling versus interacting with people on these apps. How do you advise young people, parents, to use these in healthier ways?
Well, happily, I've got two sources that I can draw upon when I provide advice in this. And first is something that we talked about back when these lawsuits were just being introduced back in 2023 when you and I talked. Mm-hmm. I pointed to the U.S. Surgeon General's advisory on social media and youth mental health. And the recommendations in that report, and again, that report really kind of kicked it off for many attorneys general to launch these lawsuits.
Yeah.
The recommendations in that also match the recommendations of Dr. Michael Rich, who is the founder and director of the Digital Wellness Lab at Boston Children's Hospital. And both starts by encouraging adults to model positive behaviors with their devices. And we can see this when we go into restaurants or when we go into public spaces. You know, adults are always mad that their children are doom scrolling, that they can't take their eyes off their phone. But just look around at where adults' attention are.
Right.
And we cannot expect our children to have better behaviors than we do. But something that I really like, you know, from Dr. Rich's perspective is this idea of giving them an alternative. You know, researchers look at why young people are using these devices. And they're using them to fulfill some fairly basic developmental needs that aren't being met in other domains. So the answer is not only to like forbid these devices or forbid these apps, but give them places where their developmental needs can be met.
Like in-person activities, things like that?
Exactly. You know, Lauren, whenever I talk to focus groups of kids, one of my first questions to all of them, just to kind of get them talking, is I simply ask them what they like to do when they're not in school. And, you know, I would say in a focus group of eight kids, I would say six to eight. It's rare that a kid says that their favorite thing to do is spend time on their phone. Invariably, they say that their favorite thing to do is hang out with friends or play a sport or do something like draw. They have hobbies that are IRL, that are in real life, that involve interacting with real people, and they enjoy them, and they want more of that.
Right.
So there are alternatives, and we just have to provide them.
Yeah. So then, Brad, the question becomes, like, where is the line, I guess? Like, you can tell people to use these things healthily or in better ways. But if the argument is that, you know, you're giving your kids cigarettes essentially and then expecting them not to be addicted to it, I mean, is that something they can regulate on their own, or is this really that addictive?
You know, there is a science, a neuroscience to this that I don't fully understand. What I have read has said that it's inappropriate to liken the addiction to a cigarette addiction simply because of the chemicals that are involved, because no chemicals are introduced into the body through the device. Rather, you're triggering chemicals that your body already produces in reaction to different stimuli,
right,
and you can provide different stimuli and get those same chemicals going.
Yeah.
So I think the analogy isn't quite right. But what we do for sure need to do is make sure that we as adults know what our kids are doing online. And the simplest thing to get that started is to ask them. This is a big deal in the monitoring, is to be there present to your child having them show you what they're doing online and I hate to say it, sometimes participating so that you fully get what they are getting out of it and can have informed discussions about it. And actually, my big concern is that parents and adults are going to look at this ruling and they're going to say, oh, good, you know, Meta is being held accountable. YouTube is being held accountable. I don't have to worry anymore.
And my point is that the case. Yeah.
I don't, because there's going to be another app. There's going to be another screen. There's going to be another, you know, service. And we've done nothing, as I mentioned before, my first analogy. You know, we've punished the automotive manufacturer for having an unsafe automobile, but we haven't taught the kid how to drive better.
Yeah, and that's the trick.
That's the trick.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Brad Snyder, an author, researcher, host of the podcast Talking About Kids. He studies kids, obviously. Brad, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for your perspective
you're very
here.
Welcome.
I appreciate it.
Very welcome.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, sleep is incredibly important to overall health, but it's often disputed for people working late nights or inconsistent shifts. We'll hear more from a sleep researcher about what we know of sleep health for shift workers and what can help keep them healthy.
But first, a former Peoria high school teacher and soccer coach is facing federal charges and is under investigation for allegations that she groomed a student while he was a minor. Haley Beck was fired from her job at Centennial High School in March. Now, text messages between Beck and the student that were collected by Peoria police are out. And our next guest reports they are what one expert called a playbook of the predatory process. Hannah Dreyfus is an investigative reporter at the Arizona Republic and reported this story. And joins me now in studio to talk more about it. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for coming in. So you spoke with a child safety expert that I referenced there about these messages, which were text messages, but also via various social media apps. And they called them like a playbook, right? Tell us more about what was said, what the patterns that were shown here through these messages.
Sure. So grooming is a process. It's a manipulative process where an adult tries to progressively get into a child's life. And a lot of times you'll see patterns of boundary crossing behaviors, behaviors that show secrecy, favoritism, gift giving. These are some of the signs of what is considered grooming. And all of these came up in the text messages that police collected over the course of their investigation into these Peoria teachers.
Yeah. And these messages began, it sounds like quite a long time ago. The student, when the police investigation took place, was over the age of 18, but was not when these messages began, right?
Exactly. These messages began when the student was a sophomore and about 16 years old. And what you'll see in grooming behavior patterns is a progressive movement towards more and more boundary-crossing behaviors. And so what began as sort of pushing the limits with a teacher-student relationship progressed into something a lot more nefarious.
Mm-hmm. There is a second teacher implicated in all of this, too?
Yes, there's a second teacher, Angela Berlaca, who is also facing federal charges for sending explicit content and videos to actually the same student.
Mm. So what do we know about this teacher, Haley Beck? The story has gone viral, partly at least, because she's the sister of like a TikTok star, right?
Yeah, she is. She's the sister of a TikTok star, and she's the daughter of two other teachers and Peoria district employees, to the best of my knowledge. Mm. So what we know about her is that she was relatively young, that she had a very social and casual relationship with her students, one that she was open about on social media to the extent where students were sharing pictures of their teacher, sort of putting her hands around their waist, around their shoulders. And we know that she felt passionately about her job, and clearly it crossed into spaces that took it far too far.
Yeah. So now she's facing one recommended count of pandering, which is, you know, not exactly the charge I expected to be talked about, but it appears to have to do with the money that she sent to this student.
Yeah. So over the course of more than a year, she sent over $600 to this student in Apple Payments and just, you know, $25 here, $30 here, sometimes for alcohol, sometimes, you know, just for looking at a picture of her and commenting. Mm. And so it was a behavior of gaining control using finances.
Yeah. What does that count entail in terms of a potential sentence here?
So I think we're looking at there is some potential jail time involved. I believe it's up to two years maximum. And I guess right now, just to clarify, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office has not yet decided whether to press charges. Mm-hmm. These are the recommended charges based on the Peoria Police Department. Mm-hmm. But if they do proceed, there are some really serious consequences that come along with that. With that accusation and that charge.
Yeah, so we're still waiting to see what the Maricopa County Attorney's Office does here. What has Beck said about this, or have you spoken with her attorney?
So I did try and get in touch with Beck directly, as I always do. She did not want to talk. I heard from her attorney who said that his client has committed no crimes and that she has the due process ahead of her, like anyone accused of a crime, and that people should let that process play out before coming to conclusions.
Yeah. What about school officials? What have they had to say about this? I said that she was let go from her job, but this has been going on for quite a while, this investigation. And the Republic found that school officials were alerted by, it sounds like, another student to some of this behavior, but didn't act on it for some time.
Yeah, sure. So that's been actually one of the biggest focuses of my reporting, because I'm always looking to do accountability journalism and looking at how school officials responded to what happened rather than just what happened. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that the school principal at Centennial High School was actually alerted by a former student to this teacher's behaviors 6 months before police got involved. And that email alerting him to these behaviors, including Beck sitting in a car with a student, exchanging Snapchats with them and giving gifts to the student, all typical of grooming behavior patterns, that was brought to the principal's attention in February of 2025. Mm. Now, why no action was taken for a long time is a question that I'm continuing to explore. The school district has said in response to my questions that at the time that the principal found out about these things, they didn't rise to the level of abuse that would be necessary to report. However, these grooming behavior patterns are specifically mentioned in training materials for reportable offenses in Arizona state materials when it comes to reportable mandatory reporting requirements.
Right.
So questions are still, I'm still researching these questions.
Right. And teachers are mandatory reporters, so it's raising questions about that.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, just before I let you go here, what's next in this case? We mentioned we're still waiting on charges from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office if they decide to pursue action there. And are you waiting for more answers here, it sounds like, from the district?
I'm absolutely waiting for more answers from the district. And not only that, please, you know, check back at the AZ Central to see more accountability journalism that goes all the way up to the state level, which should be publishing this week, which looks at how state authorities, what they knew and if they acted, and if not, why not? Mm. So once again, pushing the accountability level all the way past the district and up to the highest echelons of the folks in our state who are responsible for keeping students safe.
Sounds like lots more to come on this investigation. Hannah Dreyfus, investigative reporter with the Arizona Republic, joining us. Hannah, thank you for coming in.
Of course. Thank you guys so much.
Recent news about the Colorado River has been not great. Less water, missed deadlines, disagreement between upper and lower basin states, threats to Lakes Mead and Powell. And if all of that isn't enough to cause concern or worse, our next guest has written a piece of fiction based on that data and published science. Len Nessefer lives in Tucson and is the owner and founder of a media company called Natives Outdoors. His piece, called "The Colorado River Does Not Reach 2030, is at times a difficult read. It starts with the following sentence. The storm that killed Phoenix arrived on the evening of July 14, 2027, dragging a wall of dust 3,000 feet high. I spoke earlier with Nessefer about the piece, and we started with what prompted him to want to write it.
So I've been working on issues in and around the Colorado River probably for the past, I'd say 5 to 6 years. I was taken on one of my first river trips was walking down the Yampa River in August of 2021. And so the Yampa River is the largest undammed tributary of the Colorado in the state of Colorado. And I walked down that river in August of 2021, which was its lowest recorded levels in human history. Did this with the trip with a well-known photographer, storyteller around the river, Pete McBride. And, you know, that story just sort of grounded me in the seriousness of what was coming with the river. And now we're in a similar state that we were around that time with lake levels at Lake Powell. We're looking at one of the lowest recorded runoffs from snowpack in Colorado, and that's going to affect us down here. And so I've been seeing, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the news, and I was trying to figure out how do we bring this to the forefront of tying together all these separate ideas around climate impacts and drought and infrastructure. And I haven't been able to find an answer. And I think this struck a chord.
Well, so do you consider this science fiction? I mean, as you say, sort of in the introduction, that, you know, all the elements in this story are drawn from published science and that the chain of events is plausible. So I guess, how do you classify what you've written here?
I mean, I would call it near-term science fiction. You know, there's a lot of things here that, you know, the way that I lined it out sort of assumed a certain series of events and certain triggers. But, you know, as we're all aware, there can be black swan events. There can be a whole host of other things that can occur. So I would say that this gives us a sketch of one possibility of how things could play out. But by no means am I trying to predict the future here. I think one of the pieces that I was trying to do is really tie a lot of these threads together and to give us sort of a range of ideas of what's possible. And definitely here is, you know, it's scary. And but, you know, a lot of these events may happen in sort of a very discrete parts of a timeline. And I think in terms of bundling those all together and showing them how they connect, I think that's really that sort of system level analysis that I want to provide to people and give them an understanding, and at least of where my brain's been living for the past 5 to 6 years.
Yeah. What was it like for you to write this? And I mostly ask because I found myself like kind of gasping every so often as I was reading it. Like it was terrifying.
You know, I think for me, this was a little bit of a cathartic process, at least in trying to put some of my own generalized anxiety around these issues and what we may face into writing. You know, I get to see incredible things and meet incredible people. And I think one of the real parts of the story that I just felt was so important, at least for my work, was to tie a thread through all of these different peoples and these different scenarios that I've been encountering.
Okay, so you mentioned trying to tie a bunch of maybe disparate things together. Could I ask you to read a paragraph from this piece? It is toward the end, but not quite at the end, which I think kind of illustrates the point that you're trying to make there.
Yeah. This is how complex systems fail. Not all at once. Not with a bang. One misforecast, one dry winter, one bankrupt ditch company, one fallowed field, one closed laundromat, one protest ignored, one U-Haul loaded for Duluth, one thermostat turned up to 85 because the bill was too high. Each step seemed manageable. Together, they constituted a transformation of the American West that none of the people making the decisions had voted for, planned for, or believed was possible until it had already happened.
So one of the things that stood out to me about this piece was that, you know, so many of us have heard so much about the Colorado River and we've heard about climate change and some of the big factors. But and this paragraph you just read kind of points to that. And the piece really talks about this. A lot of sort of the smaller things that are going on that most of us don't notice, or if we do notice, we don't kind of think about them as something that could be significant in how this part of the world is changing.
100%. And I think, you know, my training and graduate work was largely in the realm of risk perception and how do we perceive risk as humans. And one of the challenges that we face is that we're wired to respond to immediate risks and not once, 100 years in the future. And I think very much we're in this, the analogy of the frog in the boiling pot of water is apt here. But I think these sort of tools that we have to sort of elicit imaginations or futures that don't exist through things like fictional writing, I think, is one of the tools of the arts and of the arts to basically explain the sciences. And I just hope that, people read this and feel like that there is still room to address this and that this is not a future that is written in stone and is very much changeable.
Okay, so I want to ask you about that, because one of the things that you wrote again in the introduction is the unsettling part is how little I had to invent, sort of to the, mm-hmm. The science fiction part of the fiction part of the science fiction. It sounds like you don't think that this is necessarily inevitable, that, the ship has not sailed on all this.
Yeah, I think with one of the quotes that I pull from one of my graduate advisors was, all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Okay.
And so, and what I provided here was just like a model output of what a potential future could look like. And I don't think that, maybe one or two of these things happen, but I don't think the whole host of things will happen exactly how I lay out. There's a whole range of possibilities. And of course, human societies are complex and things can change very quickly. And I think one of the pieces that I really wanted to highlight was just how complex and how interdependent, and also just how much this is not in the forefront of our thinking, especially, it comes up here in Arizona, but it is not the major talking point I see throughout the state. And I think that might change if some of these things happen, especially with cap water and other things upriver.
So I'm curious, what gives you optimism when you look around?
What I see and what I constantly return to is that there are incredibly smart people, there are incredibly smart policymakers, and there's incredibly motivated people who are wanting to make this change, to have an Arizona that we can live in that's sustainable, that lives within our means when it comes to water. And I think I see crises and the potential future that we're seeing with the Colorado River as an opportunity. There's, in many respects, it is a policy window to make substantial changes that we wouldn't make before. And maybe there is a reality in which this could be different. And I think priming the pump a little bit through pieces like fiction and other sorts of things can really begin to drive that conversation to create the political will to honestly, hopefully make this the negotiations around the river, how we manage water here in the state, be something that works for everyone throughout the basin.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Len Nessefer. Len, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Mother Road, established in 1926. The historic Route 66 spanned more than 2,400 miles from Chicago to Santa Monica. It was an important migration path for farm workers during the Dust Bowl of the 1930s and served as a precursor to the nation's highway system as Americans became more mobile than ever before. And, of course, its signage has become iconic around the world. But one part of its history that's not often talked about is its indigenous history. More than half of those 2,400 miles pass through Indian country, and much of it follows ancient Native American hunting trails or trade routes. But if you see references to its Native American history today, they're probably buried in kitsch. Mona Gable wrote about the appropriation of Native American culture for Afar magazine. She's a member of the Chickasaw tribe in Oklahoma, and I spoke with her more about what this looks like on Route 66.
It looks like concrete teepees, Indian wooden heads of statues. And unfortunately, a lot of times these artifacts, they misrepresent the particular tribe that they're supposed to be representing. So, for example, there is no such thing as a concrete teepee. And yet there is an entrepreneur who built a series of motels along Route 66 that were concrete teepees.
Yeah. A famous kind of wigwam village motel, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that misrepresents even what the indigenous history looks like in this part of the country, right?
Right. And that's a lot of the problem along Route 66 is, you know, there are 574 registered federal tribes in the United States. And of course, Route 66 encompasses dozens and dozens of those tribes. And yet when Route 66 was built, the roadway was actually built, all that history was really ignored along the route in favor of misappropriating the history or illustrating stereotypes from Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the marketing campaign was right. to draw tourists to these sort of romantic images of American Indians.
And the Wild West kind of idea, yeah.
Yeah.
And the history goes back even further than Route 66, right? Like, this is built upon a corridor that existed already of indigenous trade routes, right?
Exactly. And it touches on many of those trade routes. It directly goes through some of them, but it also is very close to many of the ancestral trade routes. You have access to all of these incredible cultural resources and natural resources that have been in the area for hundreds and hundreds of years, and in some cases, thousands of years.
Yeah, yeah. So there's an effort now to reclaim this history from indigenous folks along this. The American Indigenous Tourism Association is right. trying to kind of talk about this, especially in light of the centennial. What do indigenous folks have to say right now about this history and its impact?
They're very forthright about it. The people that I've interviewed are very honest about the impact that it's had on their communities and on also their cultural identities and how they've been represented, misrepresented to people coming along the highway. And so that is really why there's this very concerted effort among many, many tribes and, of course, the Indigenous Tourism Association to correct that and to provide authentic experiences to travelers going along Route 66.
Right. So what does that look like? I mean, you kind of outlined some places people might consider stopping that have actual ties to indigenous communities, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And many of those, I mean, are things that you have heard about, too, are like there are powwows along the route that you can research. You know, there are restaurants, there are lots of nature activities like hikes, especially in places in New Mexico and Arizona, where you have indigenous tribal people who have started businesses. Mm-hmm. And there's one called Navajo Tours USA, which I'm very impressed with what they've been doing. And it's a small operation and they do tours in some of the most beautiful desert wilderness areas in Arizona.
Yeah.
So that's not something you would normally encounter if you were just driving along Route 66,
right.
something you would certainly have to look for. But there are also lots of museums. Santa Fe has an area called Museum Hill, which has three museums on top, which all offer some insights into different American tribes.
Yeah.
You know, the point is these organizations and individuals who are running businesses, they really want to present to travelers an honest depiction, an authentic depiction of whatever their tribe's life was like in that area.
Hmm.
And we have a new one actually that I wrote about in my article. It's the Chumash tribe. They're outside of Los Angeles, up near Santa Barbara. And they have a brand new museum that they took many, many years to build. And it's really a replica. A lot of it is a replica of what the Chumash lifestyle and their villages were really like.
Hmm.
It's exciting to see this happening because it's like taking back the real history of Route 66.
It's really interesting. Can you tell us about the Hubble Trading Post? I've never been here and it sounds so interesting. It's like the oldest operating trading post on the Navajo Nation, you say.
Yeah, this story is so odd because it was founded by a white guy who had been trading with Native Americans in different areas. And he had a really good relationship with the tribes that he was trading with. Mostly it was blankets, woven blankets, things like that. And it was owned by his family, I think, for three generations. And now I think the National Park Service is in charge of it. But they pretty much have kept it just the way it is, so that there are all these handicrafts and goods that they sell that are all made by Native Americans. And so it's really a wonderful slice of history. And it's really great that it still exists.
Yeah. So let me ask you lastly, Mona, just about, you know, as you're talking to folks and visiting these places and writing about this, especially on the centennial of Route 66, which is so celebrated right now all along the route.
Right.
What do you think the impact of this could be, of this kind of rethinking of the history of Route 66, in not just a, you know, this was bad and we shouldn't appropriate
right.
these things kind of way, but in a positive way in which we're celebrating that real history?
I think that's one thing that the Indigenous Tourism Association, they really hope that people see this as an opportunity to incorporate Native American culture into their travels, and that it will reveal, you know, so much more about Native American tribes than people imagined.
Yeah, yeah, in a really interesting way. All right. Mona Gabel, a writer for Afar magazine, author of the book Searching for Savannah, The Murder of One Native American Woman and the Violence Against the Many. Mona, thank you for coming on to talk to me about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. It was a pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Kat Kennedy is a postdoctoral researcher who studies sleep, specifically circadian rhythms and what happens when they're disturbed. For office workers, maybe that means the odd late night or early morning. But Kennedy is particularly interested in the sleep patterns of shift workers, people who work in fields like food service, long-haul trucking, and nursing. These workers tend to have schedules that make it hard to get enough sleep or consistent sleep, and Kennedy's research at the University of Arizona's Bio5 Institute focuses on what these disruptions mean for their health. Kennedy spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman more about it.
We know that when we try and force sleep at a time when our bodies are not set up to be sleeping well, so thinking here of the person who's, let's say, trying to sleep during the day so that they can be on the night shift, we know that their sleep tends to be impaired just because there's a mismatch between their biological drive and what the behavior is that they're trying to do. So they have a biological drive to be awake because it's the daytime, but they're trying to engage in this sleep behavior because they have to be up at night to be working.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about some of the issues that shift workers encounter that correspond to difficult sleeping circumstances.
What we seem to see is that for people who are experiencing shift work, especially these kind of rotating shifts where their body's not really able to adjust to any type of schedule, we tend to see that there are worse health outcomes in a lot of these people. I like to say this with sort of the caveat that there's no need to assume the very worst if you are a shift worker right now, because there's lots of things that, you know, I'm happy to talk about this, lots of things that you can do to help yourself. But we do sort of see worse health outcomes for a lot of these people, just because these body clocks, these clocks that we have in virtually every single cell in our bodies really dictate basically everything that the body does.
Right, right. And this can be something as simple, if I'm not mistaken, as driving home after working an overnight shift. You're physically exhausted, but the sun is rising. And so, and you've been up all night. So your body is telling you that it's time to sleep, but your body is also receiving signals from the environment that the day is just beginning.
Right. That's exactly it. Because, you know, if you're working during the day and then you're kind of unwinding after work, it's getting darker, right? The sun has set, even in sort of extreme latitudes where there's longer days, you still eventually experience this period of darkness before bed and or before you're going to sleep. And that's really important because people have heard of melatonin, right? Melatonin is a really important signal for our brains that says, hey, it's nighttime. And it serves as this really important antioxidant that gets to work in our bodies while we're sleeping.
And as I understand it, some of the health outcomes that shift workers are at higher risk for would be things like weight gain, appetite loss, mood disorders, loneliness, which I thought was an interesting one.
Right. That's correct. So yeah, we definitely see a higher risk of different cardiometabolic disorders. So this could be things like weight gain, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, things like this. We see things like irritable bowel syndrome, which is reported quite commonly. And this tends to be worse among people who are on rotating shifts, because essentially you're trying to eat when your body is not really primed for food, because let's say you've just switched from a different shift schedule the day before. During that shift schedule, you were eating at a completely different time. And your body's like, hey, this wasn't the time we ate yesterday. I'm not necessarily set up to be eating right now.
Right.
And so that can lead to sort of some gastrointestinal issues. But the loneliness one, yeah, it's something that I've heard many people sort of anecdotally, as I've spoken to people over the years, heard many people discuss that it can be really challenging if you have a, you know, the family members, your partner, your spouse, things like that, on a completely different shift to you, because you're having to say no to things. You're having to say no to social, you know, various different social opportunities because you might be working, or you're really trying to recover before you switch to the night shift the next day. And so there's sort of that extra time that's needed to recuperate. So it's really just some missed opportunities sometimes that can come.
Right. And so this gets into what you were alluding to earlier, the idea that if someone is listening to this and is a shift worker and getting alarmed, which would be understandable, there are ways to counteract some of the deleterious effects of shift work on sleep that you are able to share. One of those is finding a consistent sleep schedule, right? Even if it's not the same sleep schedule that others might keep to.
That's right. Your consistency in your sleep timing is associated with better health across the board. So that's something that's really important to keep in mind. The general recommendation right now for people who do have shifts that chop and change, which might be unavoidable for you if you're a rotating nurse, for example, is to at least try and have half of your sleep episode. So most of us aiming for between 7 and 9 hours of sleep per night, try and have at least half of that. So 3.5, 4 hours, something like that, that is overlapping between all of your shifts. So as best as possible, try and have what we'd consider to be like these anchor hours of say 4 hours that don't change no matter what shift you're on. Mm-hmm. And that just has a way of kind of tethering us to some amount of routine, even if our shifts are changing a lot around that.
So this gets tricky though, right? Because shift work positions are often associated with not as much flexibility, right? In terms of how much control workers have over their schedules and things like that.
That's right. And this is where, you know, it really is down to the employer. And a question that I sort of think about a lot is who is responsible for shift work to begin with, mm-hmm. who can take responsibility for it. It's something that we all as a society, I think, take for granted, especially when we think of all these essential services that are available around the clock, whether that's, you know, first responders who will help us in a crisis, to even things like picking up your coffee at 6, 7 in the morning. There's a barista who's had to be up, you know, a couple hours before that. You know, we all take, I think, a lot of these services for granted. It's so normal in this 24/7 society that we have that it sort of, yeah, begs the question, who is responsible?
I know that some of that overlaps with other work that you've done on sleep insofar as it affects women's bodies, right? And a lot of shift workers, I mean, we've mentioned nurses a few times, are women, and it seems like female nurses are sort of in double jeopardy there.
That's right. So, you know, women's sleep health is a largely understudied area, as is shift work. And the issue, so the reason that shift work is understudied is just because it's a really difficult population to get to participate in research studies. You know, mm-hmm. these are often really high stress roles. And the women especially, you know, I do a lot of women's health research, and women have largely been left out of biomedical research for most of history. And so we're playing catch up across the board now in terms of having to include female, whether it's animals in animal studies or humans in human participant research. And it's really critical because not only because we have females filling these shift work roles, but because females experience many changes across the lifespan, right? So there's the kind of premenopausal years when many females are experiencing menstrual cycles, meaning completely different hormonal changes across the month. They might be using hormonal contraceptives, which I'm particularly interested in, which again, completely change the hormonal milieu in the body. Then there's things like pregnancy and postpartum. There's things like the menopause transition. So there are all of these really massive changes that happen in women's health across the lifespan. I think it's really important to be giving attention to women especially and some of the unique ways that they might be a bit more vulnerable.
Well, I have been speaking with Kat Kennedy, who is a postdoctoral researcher and works in the social, cognitive, and affective neuroscience, aka the SCAN lab at the University of Arizona. Kat, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Feeling tired just listening to that one, Mark. That'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. You can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.